Now, I want to summarize what I said last time by referring what I did not do last time to Tom Brown, which I gather from Barry, most of you haven't even started to read yet. Of course, you haven't started your papers either. But they're due next Friday, and we don't accept any excuses, as you well know. You know, this is a Stalinist course from that point of view. And, you know, so don't come to us then whining that something or other happened, yes? Because nothing happens to you ever. So you're the new generation. Nothing happens to you. Pity. Anyhow, however that may be, let me go to Tom Brown to sum things up. Let me point to page 68, when the squire, his father, who is again typifies this voluntary service, the squire, he's a magistrate, says why he is sending Tom Brown to Rugby. And he says, "I don't care a straw for Greek particles or the diagama. No more does his mother. What is he sent to school for? Well, partly because he wanted so to go. If he'd only turn out a brave, helpful, truth-telling Englishman and a gentleman and a Christian, that's all I want." So again, you have from the beginning here in 1857 the note that we talked about last time of a Christian gentleman. Let me point to page 118, which is a sermon which Thomas Arnold preaches in chapel. And remember the centrality of chapel to education, the centrality to exhortation. And what he says again is, "It was not the cold, clear voice, Christ's voice." He's talking about the voice of Christ. "Christ's voice is not the cold, clear voice of one giving advice and warning from serene heights to those who were struggling and sinning below, but the warm, living voice of one who was fighting for us and by our side and calling on us to help him and ourselves and one another. And so wearily, little by little." Remember what that means, little by little. I read you the other day, and in case you want to read it, I pronounce these things not so good. Farrar, Eric, or little by little. But here the exhortation is little by little to virtue and not little by little to vice, clearly. So, "and so wearily, little by little, but surely and steadily on the whole, was brought home to the young boy for the first time the meaning of his life, that it was no fool's or sluggard's paradise into which he had wandered by chance, but a battlefield ordained from old, where there are no spectators, but the youngest must take his side and the stakes are life and death." A battlefield of sin and virtue, of course, in case you don't get it. I wouldn't be surprised. "And he who roused his consciousness in them showed them at the same time, by every word he spoke in the pulpit and by his whole daily life, how that battle was to be fought, and stood there before them, their fellow soldier and captain of their band." Now, I remind you of the famous hymn sung at Rugby, as it was sung in my school, "Onward, Christian Soldiers." A hymn that comes from the same time, that has the same content, of course. Life is a battlefield. And you see, I'm sure, the evangelical origins of all of this. And the gospel of work. It is no sluggard's paradise that you have wandered into. And then, of course, at the end, fair play. And this is clear in the most famous scene from the whole book, the fighting scene on page 231, when Tom Brown takes on the bully, the school bully. "Boys will quarrel." Now, before I do this, though, I want to remind you again of the Fairchild family of 1818, where brother and sister quarrel, and they're put and sat underneath the gallows all night, because that's the end you come to. Always you sink into vice little by little, you see. Little sins, bigger sins follow. You weren't educated with that. I certainly was. I certainly was. You know, a little sin, a bigger sin follows. You start, and God knows where you get, yes? When my sister first voted Social Democrat, in my house that wasn't done. In 1830, my mother accused her of having next an illegitimate child. Tells you something about how the Social Democrats were regarded, we think, as so mild in 1930. I'll never forget that scene, you know. Boys will quarrel, and when they quarrel, will sometimes fight. Fighting with fists is the natural and English way for English boys to settle their quarrels. What substitute for it is there, or ever was there, among any nation under the sun? What would you like to see take its place? Learn to box then, as you learn to play cricket and football. Not one of you will be the worse, but very much the better for learning to box well. Should you never have to use it in earnest, there's no exercise so good for the temper, the muscle of the backs and legs. As to fighting, now notice this, keep out of it if you can by all means. When the time comes, if it ever should, that you have to say yes or no to a challenge to fight, say no if you can. Only take care you make it clear to yourself why you say no. It's a proof of the highest courage if done from true Christian motives. It's quite right and justifiable if done from a simple aversion to physical pain and danger. It is not, I mean, right and justifiable. But don't say no because you fear a licking and say or think it's because you fear God. For that's neither Christian nor honest. In other words, a coward. That is the lowest. In other words, you have to fight. But if you fight, fight it out. And don't give in while you can stand and see. Fight the fair fight. A glorification, in a way, of the fair fight. Now, this idea in rugby of the fair fight, soon after Arnold's death, became transmuted into something Arnold despised, sport. And from then on in, sport, especially soccer, became the religion of the school, because after 1857, it's the beginning of football in England, then eventually in Europe, the beginning of the first football clubs. And what you have, therefore, is the beginning of this sport immediately going into the school, becoming a kind of passion with the boys, but being manipulated, or whatever you want, as I said last time, to teach fair play, the good fight, yes? Because it's not a fight between bullies. Soccer is played between Christian gentlemen. This can't be said for American football, of course, not in this sense. Now, all this began after Arnold's time without changing the basic character of the school. But it plays into something else which becomes important. Together with the cult of sport being superimposed on this Christian gentleman ideal, you get from the 1860s on what we would call, what was called then, I'm sorry, the cult of manliness. Manliness, which goes hand in hand with the exaltation of the sports in schools. It is really a fruit of the anti-intellectualism that was always built in. Remember last time I read you Thomas Arnold's precedents, and first precedent was to be moral, second was to be a gentleman, and only a third was to be clever, yes? So the anti-intellectualism led to not only the exaltation of sports, of course, but also this idea of manliness. God had given man physical prowess to use, which was, of course, heightened by the fact that these schools trained students to go out and rule the empire, that it trained, if you like, a ruling elite, not only for England, but for the empire. And again, it was Thomas Hughes who popularized this, in 1861, when he wrote, first of all, a sequence to Tom Brown's school days, which you can read, called Tom Brown at Oxford. And then when he gave some very famous lectures, to which I shall come in a minute, called The Manliness of Christ. The Manliness of Christ, given to workers' colleges, come to in 67. So Thomas Hughes is again the popularizer. And in Thomas Hughes at Tom Brown at Oxford, he has the famous definition, very famous definition, of what was called muscular Christianity. And the manliness of Christ is the same as muscular Christianity. These things were used interchangeable, yes? Now, here is the famous definition of what this became, the ideal of muscular Christianity. And I will comment as I read you the classical passage. The muscular Christian has hold of the old chivalrous and Christian belief that a man's body is given to him to be trained and brought in subjection. In other words, self-control. That goes with respectability. That goes with purity, obviously. A man's body is given to him to be trained and brought into subjection, and then used for the protection of the weak, the advancement of all righteous causes, and the subduing of the earth. Now notice the connection here between protecting orphans and mothers, as it were, the weak, as Tom Brown takes on the bully, fighting against bullies, but at the same time, of course, the quest for domination, dominating the earth, domination over nature, a very important concept, nature and empire, which God has given to the children of men. So again, it is this evangelical idea heightened that God has given the earth to men to subjugate, to control. In other words, you get a theory that becomes vastly important for this ruling class, and not only in England, the ruling of the empire. You not only exercise self-control over yourself, but you extend that self-control over the earth. When they said here, dominating the earth, which God has given to the children of men, God has given them to the children of men to teach it virtue, to teach it advancement, to teach it the kind of virtues I'll come to today with Samuel Smiles. That is to say, gospel of work. And here you can see again why Rudyard Kipling called the Indians children, why the natives were, as it were, children. He does not hold, the muscular Christian, does not hold that mere strength or activity are in themselves worthy of any respect or worship, or that one man is a bit better than the other because he can knock him down or carry a bigger sack than potatoes. It's the game that counts, not winning it. A man isn't better than another because he can knock him down or carry a bigger sack of potatoes. That's the American ethos. For mere power, whether of body or intellect, he has, I hope and believe, no reverence whatsoever. Although, now notice that, he would probably himself, as a matter of taste, prefer the man who can lift 100 weight around his head with his little finger to the man who can construct a string of perfect sorites, that's mathematics, or expound the doctrine of the contradictory inconceivables, that's philosophy. In other words, the anti-intellectualism is again built in here, of course, that though a man isn't preferred because he knocks down another man or can carry a big sack of potato, as a matter of taste, you would really prefer a man who can lift weights with 100 weight with his little finger to a mathematician or a philosopher. That is then the muscular Christian. And this idea of muscular Christianity is an idea, first of all, of regeneration. Of regeneration of the nation. And a regeneration of the middle class, of course, as the ruling elite. That's clear. It's a doctrine of regeneration. And it is, of course, eventually greatly influenced by Darwinism and the struggle of survival of the fittest, except that it never becomes Darwinist. That's a misconception, because the struggle is tempered by being a Christian gentleman. So all of this idea of a Christian gentleman, this idea of muscular Christianity, is also a way of controlling and tempering laissez-faire, tempering competition, tempering that side of liberalism. It goes hand in hand with respectability. Now, this is not confined to England. It becomes a general middle class ideal. I'll just give you another example, which some of you are already aware. The man who coined the phrase degeneration, which is the opposite of all of this, weak nerves and so on, Max Nordau, in his address to the Second Congress of Zionists, he became a Zionist, Second Congress of Zionists in 1899, transferred it to Jews. He made a famous distinction between muscle Jews and coffee house Jews. Yes? And the Zionists, of course, are the muscle Jews. And all other Jews who sit around in Vienna in these coffee houses, obviously, are coffee house Jews. And coffee house Jews are pale and they are nervous. And muscle Jews are like the same thing. You can take that right, you can take a speech right out of Thomas Hughes. They are like muscular Christians, the same thing. They train their bodies, they have fair play. They are, of course, anti-intellectual and all of that sort of thing. And so you get, for Jews, the founding of the gymnastics organization as the essence of Zionism, and you get the kind of anti-intellectualism that accompanies all nationalism, because obviously this is part of readiness and preparedness for wars and ruling empire. So all nationalism is anti-intellectual, but you get this kind of glorification of the body, but self-control of the body, not what we call later on the rediscovery of the body as a sensuous instrument. That would be degenerate, of course, for them. But the body as control. So you get that same thing, whether you are a coffee house Jew or a coffee house Christian. Don't know what I have in front of me, a mixture. Yeah, yes, please. It's fine, yes. Yes, of course. Yes, very great intellectual. All nationalism, very, indeed. Very much so. They all have an anti-intellectual in it, like all nationalism, the glorification, as let us say, of the muscle Jew, of the gymnastics organization. It just comes later in some nations than in others. It depends on the degree of nationalism. I know about the Bible and the peasant and all of this. Flowing the land, reading the Bible, but don't forget there the Bible isn't something intellectual, there it's the basic document of nationalism. That's something quite different. That is, if a German went around and read whatever goes there. Anyhow, the muscular Christianity, what you have it symbolizing is something that goes much deeper, what I would call the cult of manliness. The manliness of Christ, the muscular Christianity, the manliness of Christ. It goes deeper than that, deeper than England. And here again, I have to make some connections for you of what we discussed already before, so you can put it in the right kind of context. Namely, this idea of manliness takes and deepens the idea of friendship of the 19th century. Of the idea of male society and male associations, which had been deepened and heightened by the wars which stand at the beginning of the 19th century, which had really transformed what was already a male society in a still into a still more aggressive male society, and which made nationalism, which was involved in all of this, of course, ever a more male affair. It's onward Christian gentlemen. It isn't onward Christian women. Christian women are where they belong, at home. It's the Christian gentlemen who win wars. So, in other words, the evangelical movement already has this. Nationalism takes it over, yes? Because national hymns are just adaptations, usually, of student drinking songs, so that are fraternity drinking songs, male drinking songs, or of hymns, and hymns, by and large, are male hymns. If you ever study them, it's the men who are important as activists in all of this. So the cult of manliness is already there. It's there then, first of all, in the 18th century idea of friendship. It is there, second of all, in all these male associations, professional associations, bakers, candlestick makers, carpenters, everything in Europe banded together in professional associations in the turn from the 18th to the 19th century. And it is there, finally, in the wars of the French Revolution and Napoleon. It becomes expressed very clearly in nationalism, which is a male affair, as it far as activist. Female is the symbol. We talked about that. The female is a symbol and a goal, but the man is the active part of nationalism. And not only of that, it becomes, of course, another thing important in England, the center of hero worship. Carlyle's hero and hero worship. The heroes are, of course, male heroes, activist male heroes. So again, you get this whole idea culminating in this idea of manliness, muscular Christianity, manliness, gymnastics as the expression of nationalism. Wandering through the landscape, these bronze Jews wandering through the landscape, whatever the national landscape might be, yes? I assure you, not reading Hegel. No. Singing folk songs, not reading Hegel. So what you have, therefore, is again this kind of an idea. It's a stage in nations. It gets less accentuated with time, but it is a stage. Now, all of this, then, is an exaltation of virility. Finally, it is directly linked with industrial society, with this idea of domination, which you have here in this quotation. Domination over the earth. Domination over the earth. Domination. Because it was this kind of virility that you needed to get ahead, either in economics or in ruling the British Empire. Yes? It's that kind of virility you needed. So that you get here an exaltation which will remain with us. And in England will be accentuated more, perhaps, than in most other nations, because the education of the English ruling class is such a segregated education from school to Oxford and Cambridge. And it continues in the clubs of London, which are segregated clubs. Yes? Segregated clubs. Still are. Conservative club, liberal club, whites, boodles, the great social clubs or political clubs are segregated. But of course you get something much more deeper now, which was unknown. The general segregation between men and women, which was not unknown to the United States as well. If you were here, you came to Madison when I came so many years ago, a woman had to use the rear entrance to the university club. And at the university club, there was, it still is, as a sort of relic, a special room to which women came. When I came to the University of Wisconsin, into the university club, no woman could come, and no woman could eat there unaccompanied by a man. So it went very deep, this separation. And of course, it comes with a whole preference for male society. In other words, Americans just did it differently. For them, they love to leave their wives for conventions and things like that. There is this great, there are no clubs, but there is this great thrust to a male society which excludes women, the boys among themselves, yes, is the idea. But what I want to tell you is that it is a new idea. You won't find it in the 18th century, but you find it now. It is part of what I've called all along the kind of de-emancipation of women in the 19th century. Now in England, to be sure, a lot of homosexuality was mixed in with it, largely because of the segregated education, quite clearly. And so you get things that you know from your own thing, because it hasn't changed much. You get very recently all these spy things, which are circles of that nature. Burgess and MacLean, Philby, or the great art historian, who block on his name at the moment, who was found out to spy for Russia for the last 30 years. I know him, but I can't think of his name, sorry. But these circles are circles. They went to school, they went to Oxford and Cambridge. These happen to be also homosexual circles in this case. But that is very widespread, a kind of manliness, this kind of manliness and this kind of operation. Finally, it goes, of course, with a kind of ruling of the empire. Lord Milner in the 19th century, the great empire building, with his group of young men, Milner's Kindergarten, it was called. I'm afraid it was a little more than just a kindergarten. Never mind. Milner's Kindergarten. Milner's Kindergarten, those civil servants he got, or Rudyard Kipling's idea of these beautiful young white administrators of the empire. In other words, all the kind of homoeroticism contained in nationalism and the national symbols, coming, as I've told you before, from Greece, really comes out in all of this, comes out in all of this. And you have this this scene, for example, I'm just giving you that, of one of the greatest builders of the empire, Gordon, of Khartoum. In the Khartoum besieged, Khartoum fell, as you know, by the Cadi, and there was a massacre of the British at Khartoum. In the last minutes, spending the last minutes of his life, really, debating whether he should give in or resist the advances of a young soldier. You get these kind of transpositions, more in England, I think, than anywhere else, because of this kind of education and this kind of definite team spirit, in a sense, team spirit, Lord Cromer, Lord Milner, all the great builders of the empire, all the great builders of the empire. In fact, there's a very good book on the empire by Higham now, which makes the point that the empire was the great sexual outlet. If these schools, if the English schools, boarding schools, were called sexual concentration camps, and they were to a large degree, I mean, you were always patrolled, you were never alone, all of that sort of thing. And if in England respectability reigned, people like Gordon and otherwise could act out their sexual fantasies in the empire. Not necessarily homosexual fantasies, but almost every other ruler of the empire had his native women. So in a sense, yes, the empire was an outlet for sexual energies in England, there's no doubt. But this whole training, this whole manliness made for these virile circles, especially in England, but elsewhere as well, who ruled and governed the empire. All of this is summed up by Thomas Hughes in his famous lectures called The Manliness of Christ. These lectures on the manliness of Christ stress exactly what I have already mentioned. They stress fair play. but the readiness to fight if necessary. The importance of domination. The importance of a sound body. The importance of fair play. Fight, but fight the good fight. Unfortunately, I say this with a great deal of the flu today anyway, with a great deal of added bad feeling, because that was inscribed over my school gym in England, fight the fair fight. And if there's anything I hated, it was my school gym. An unrepentant coffee house Jew. Never mind. Anyway, however that might be, now, these ideas that I have now put forward, were in liberalism in England, however, also applied to the lower classes. It was believed that if you were a Christian gentleman, if you had the right education, then you would advance in the social scale, and that poverty was believing, unlike Thomas Arnold, in slothfulness, in laziness. In other words, if you were a Christian gentleman, you would make it. And I told you once before that in the early days of capitalism, that was not so silly as it sounds. You could make it. To raise yourself in the middle classes. And therefore, from the middle of the century on, a series of so-called working class colleges were founded. The most famous Ruskin College in Oxford still exists. Working class colleges were founded where members of the working classes could go free of charge, not for a degree, that wasn't the idea, but to hear lectures on self-improvement, which means lectures on morality. And it is to one of these working man colleges that Thomas Hughes gave his lectures, The Manliness of Christ, gave his lectures there. But indeed, before a working man's college in the city of Leeds, the most famous of such lectures were given. The lectures which became a book, which was and is today one of the greatest secret bestsellers of all time, Samuel Smiles' Self-Help. Look at the title. Samuel Smiles' Self-Help, which was first given before the Leeds Working Men College in 1858. To this day is a bestseller in the Third World. I share a publisher with Samuel Smiles. Don't know whether I share much else. I share a publisher with Samuel. I know some of the figures. And it's astonishing. You all think the Third World reads Marx. No. The Third World reads Samuel Smiles, and for a very good reason. Marx is no help in industrialization whatsoever. Smiles is. Smiles gives you the right attitude, in a way, for industrialization, in that stage of industrialization. So it's quite illogical if you read Smiles instead of Marx. What you have there, but he came out, well, I'll come back to the date. Now, let us look at self-help, because when we look at that book for a minute, we can see again that it's a matter of attitude, that self-help isn't a matter of how to be good at the stock exchange or anything else whatsoever. And I read you, by the way, from the 71st edition of 1953, if you think that this is out of date by any chance. And it's very typical that the author of Self-Help, Samuel Smiles, other books, and these are lectures to working man colleges, let me just give you the title, Character, Duty, Thrift. That's really, you see, that's what it's all about. Character, Duty, Thrift, Great Engineers, that sort of thing. That sort of thing is what is important. Now let's look at this for a minute. It is again, in a way, a popularization of what you already know. And here he defines at the beginning what he calls national progress. National progress. What is national progress, he asks. National progress is the sum of individual industry, energy, and uprightness. You see, honesty and the gospel of work, fair play and the gospel of work. As national decay is of individual idleness, selfishness, and vice. What we are accustomed to decry as the great social evils will for the most part be found to be but outgrowths of man's own perverted life. That's one thing Mr. Stockman did not say. But that's, of course, the theory behind everything, yes? That what we call social evil is an outgrowth of man's perverted life. And that is traditional Christianity. In the 16th, 17th century or so on, poverty was thought indeed to be punishment for sin, don't forget. So this is quite a traditional view now transposed on industrial society, where indeed it is true if you had industry energy, I'm not so sure about the uprightness, you could make money, yes? You could make money. So, that is clear. It may be of comparatively little consequence how a man is governed from without, whilst everything depends upon he governs himself from within. Notice again character, evangelism, Christianity. The greatest slave is not he who is ruled by a despot, great though that evil be, but he who is in the thrall of his own moral ignorance, selfishness, and vice. Well, enough said. Now, power and struggle are nevertheless, of course, present. Listen to this. Riches and ease, it is perfectly clear, are not necessary for man's highest culture. Else had not the world been so largely indebted at all times to those who have sprung from the humbler ranks. An easy and luxurious existence does not train man to effort or encounter with difficulty, nor necessary for energetic and effective action in life. Indeed, so far from poverty being a misfortune, it may, by vigorous self-help, be converted into a blessing. Rousing a man to that struggle with the world in which, though some may purchase ease by degradation, the right-minded and true-hearted find strength, confidence, and triumph. Now, obviously, again, a mixture. The idea that world is a battlefield, and that it is easier for you to fight the battle from poverty than from riches, an old Christian idea, that the riches damned to idleness, and of course taken up by John Wesley very strongly, and by pietism, that from the humbler beginnings and from poverty, poverty is not something that is bad for you, it is good for you. It is good for you if from poverty you get the right moral attitude to struggle. And if you have that, you will not only go to heaven, you will also be rich. So again, it's an intertwining. It's an intertwining. Why? Because of the centrality of the gospel of work, the centrality of activism, which fits again with the manliness that I've talked about, which fits again with the idea of virility, the idea of activism, and the idea of domination, of dominating the earth, yes? So you can come from poor. Indeed, poverty is really not something bad, but good. But Smiles also shows you clearly that individual liberty can easily slide over into struggle, that it can become the quest for power, that in all of that what I have said, there is a very thin line, if you think about it, between the outright quest for power and the idea of the moral attitude. I mean, there's a very thin line between being a Christian gentleman and domination, yes? I mean, and power and brutality. So when you read Tom Brown, you must ask yourself, Here is the making of a Christian gentleman. But is there not built into it a certain brutality? Is it really possible to square the moral attitude, the respectability, if you like, the moral attitude, the fighting of vice? Can you really square that with an absence of brutality, as, of course, all these people thought that this harmony would produce, an absence of brutality, of fair play? What kind of brutality is built into it? And that's, of course, what is important here. Because in the bottom line, if I can put it that way, it is a worldview which is and depends on its conformity. After all, there is vice. There is always vice. And vice must be suppressed. Whether it's sexual vice or sloth, or being a coffee house person, vice must be suppressed. Therefore, as in all conformist societies, there is here suppression implied with all of this freedom. But not only that, as it is an overt theory of domination, and all of that I've read you, domination figures, you dominate yourself, you suppress your own passions, that's what self-control means. You suppress your own passions, your own vice, and then you can dominate the earth. What does that mean? It means to bring about a moral society. It means to bring about a moral society. So how much brutality is involved? That you must really ask yourself, because that is, in a sense, the big problem involved in this liberalism. So I come back to what I said already at the beginning of this discussion. What liberals give with one hand, they take away with the other. You can follow it through present politics, if you like. On the one hand, a lot of talk about free enterprise, individual climbing the ladder. Yes? But on the other hand, rigid preconditions, rigid descriptions on how you must climb the ladder. That's the only way to climb the ladder. That's the only way you make it. And rigid preconditions for respectability. So while on the one hand you have parliamentary government and constitutionalism, which I think very few of us would deny are the most civilized forms of polity there are. On the one hand you have constitutional government and parliamentarism. On the other hand, you have the cement of society. The cement of society, the thing that brings harmony through education, which is, in the Hegelian sense, the mediation, the forming of true consciousness, if you like. You have the idea of morality. You have the idea, which is in Tom Brown, of the Christian gentleman. But the Christian gentleman and respectability are the same because they both grow out of the same ideal, the ideal of the evangelical movement, the change of morality that I've talked so much from the 18th to 19th century, the change of morality, the evangelical movement. It goes into all of this, into all of this. Goes as, if you like, it culminates in this idea, in liberalism, which is, of course, tailored again, and I must emphasize that at the end. It is tailored again, first of all, to the reality of industrialization, and second of all, to the self-definition of a new class, a new ruling class, if you like, to the self-definition of the middle class. Now, I realize that that self-definition went into the working class, and that in the end, the working class have it stronger than the middle class. I realize that in the end, the working class ideas of respectability are much stronger in the working than in the middle class. Clear? So that you get it defining all of society, but it begins in defining the middle class against the aristocracy, against the lower classes, though both aristocracy and lower class begin to accept that. Now it is also clear, finally, that the system of manners and morals, the attitudes enshrined in Tom Brown, long outlasted liberal economics and liberal politics. That regardless of whether you had parliamentary government or regardless of whether you had free enterprise, the attitudes remain. And that Samuel Smiles' idea is very right, that it really doesn't matter how you're governed from without, as long as you have it within. So as liberalism emphasized that, it emphasized it correctly, because what was to be lasting in liberalism is an attitude towards life, if you like, which is the attitude of life of a Christian gentleman. Partly because it was a self-definition of the middle class, partly because it fitted in with the victories of nationalism, and partly because it really came to penetrate all parts of the population, all parts of the population. And it was, as I told you, a recipe for making it. There's no doubt about it. There's good reason why the Third World reads Sam Smiles. There's a good reason for it. This is a good recipe for making it. So what you have, therefore, is things that, again, you can test out in your own lives. Because I'm afraid if you read Tom Brown, it will seem to you almost banal, doesn't it? Almost banal, almost your own lives, your own upbringing. And that is only because this has lasted so very long, your own attitudes. It's lasted so very, very long. Yes, so very, very long. But I can tell you now that there are two problems with it. One problem is the brutality. And the other problem is, of course, the anti-intellectualism. The anti-intellectualism. There's nothing worse, is there, than being a clever boy at rugby. Would you like to have been a clever boy at that boarding school? Boy, you wouldn't have lasted long. And those of us who were clever disguised it very well. I was good at sports, so I was accepted. That's fine. That was a way of acceptance, of course, in my day. I was good at sports, only gentlemen sports, skiing and rowing, of course, not for. So I was good at that, accepted. So what happens on the whole is, therefore, that what you get there is these things which are still with us, which are still with us. The anti-intellectualism is built in, and people pay for you to have an expensive education. Not that you should learn so much as that you should make it. And that your character shall be built. Of course, as I was the one who abolished in the University of Wisconsin all student hours about sex and so on a committee, I was just abolished it on my typewriter, you know, and then had to tell the regents it's better they do it in the room than in the back of the car. That'll be cut from the program, I'm sure. You owe that to me. You owe a great deal to me and some others, all that sexual freedom. But when I came here, there were dormitory checks, don't forget. A university was still character building. Virtue was still enforced. You can't imagine that, but it's only about 12 years ago. There were dormitory checks. There were, God knows what, you forget all about that. That was still part of an education. Now, on Monday, I will start with Marx then.